Edutainment Learning is powered by Academica Virtual Education and Collegia TV. For more information, visit www.edutainmentlearning.com.
All these things that you think about adventuring, I really think about as engineering problems. You know, they're fun, they're interesting, they have lots of different things. I mean, skydiving, it was the same way. I actually, you know, I was 18 years old. A friend of mine convinced me to go skydiving. I had no interest in skydiving, but when he said it involves airplanes and it involves, you know, parachutes, and, you know, I had seen it on television and things like that, it's like, sure, yeah. I said, yes. You know, it's like, it's kind of a funny thing. Somebody will come to you with some idea, which is kind of crazy, you know, like outside of your norm. And the inclination I think most people have is to say, no, that's just not me. But, you know, you'll find in moments, you know, that saying yes to those things, moving yourself outside your comfort zone a little bit and trying new things could have dramatic impacts later in your life. And that's what happened to me. My friend from childhood, David Lane, he asked me, you know, if I could go skydiving with him the day he turned 18. I was 6 months older. So I did it. I had an intention of doing it exactly once, but I actually really enjoyed it, and he really enjoyed it, and he twisted my arm to come back a second, third time, and I've been skydiving ever since. So, you know, there's small things, but, you know, for me, I always love the engineering side, you know, and I love the, you know, I love math, I love science, I love physics, you know, all of these things just kind of combine, and all of these, you know, it allows you to think about things in a different way, and so I really enjoy that. So that's how skydiving started. Rock climbing, I went on a trip with some rock climbers and they started showing me all the tricks and love being outdoors. So, you know, that started from a Boy Scout. You know, I started in Boy Scouts and we used to go every summer for a week. So I don't know, it just keeps rolling. Flying, I always wanted to fly. You know, I finally got a chance to learn to fly at some point. You know, it was like 35 years ago or something like that. To me, it was like the most wonderful thing. So just trying new things and you know, really going deep in, I'm learning about it. Even if you can't do it, even if you can't afford to fly. I mean, I studied flying for 20 years, actually almost 30 years before I ever set foot in a small airplane. So always fun to learn.
That is really cool. And speaking of learning, you're very active in the STEM community. And one of the kids wants to know, what is it like trusting in science so much that you, was it 135,000 feet that you would float up that high and skydive pretty much from space, pretty much? What is it like trusting in science that much? Like how much math went into that?
Oh, it's a tremendous amount of math. Every single element of it had both math and science and physics. And I mean, you think it's like a one event, you know, that you go up there and you try it out. And it was what started out as one idea. I mean, the idea was scuba diving in the stratosphere, right? You know, why build a capsule, all this kind of stuff. There's lots of problems with capsules and why they tend to, you think they're going to make you safer, but you know, in my opinion, they're actually more complicated and they have a lot of failure modes that are, that you don't think about so much. So for me, it was like, well, let's just do scuba diving. Let's strap a couple tanks on and on a spacesuit and just go up. And, you know, that was the idea. But, you know, of course, it took, you know, 3 years after that idea to really perfect it in a way that will really work. But by that time, we had done a lot of tests. I mean, I had been in that spacesuit for like 150 hours. I knew how durable it was. We had tested all the skydiving configurations. You know, we'd done ground tests, we'd done airplane tests, you know, and each of those just raised the bar a little bit from where it was before. So I wouldn't recommend just buying a spacesuit and going up, but, you know, we probably did 250 tests, you know, some manned, some unmanned tests as we started to learn about the various characteristics and redesign. You know, when something didn't work, you know, there's one moment we had a really bad test, you know, it's like, it wasn't just one thing it didn't work, like three things didn't work. And so, you know, once you do that, you know, you have to step back and you say, well, what could we do, you know, that's radically different? And so we did. We spent a year and we totally redesigned the system and made it a lot safer and addressed all the issues and things like that. So for me, it's not just the, you know, just writing down a bunch of equations and hope you get it right. You know, it's, you write about a bunch of equations, you work hard, you hire a really good team, you know, that really understands the basics and they work really closely with you the whole time. You check each other's work, you know, you don't just assume. And then if you say this is going to work, that the oxygen is going to last this long, you know, you experiment with it. Let's try it on the ground and, you know, see how long it lasts there. And let's try it at, you know, higher altitudes and see how long it lasts there. So it's an iterative process, where you believe you do the science, but then you check it, you know, through real world observations. I think that cycle is super important. Don't just believe everything you read, you know. There's a story of my dad, it was always big on, you know, not believing everything you should read. And I remember there was a column in a newspaper and somebody was trying to say whether, you know, when you take a shower, do you use more water in a shower or a bath? And my dad was just hilariously laughing at this. What do you mean you use more water in a shower or a bath? You know, why are you asking some columnist in a newspaper about that? Just, you know, go in, plug up the tub, you know, take a shower and then see if the amount of water in the bath is more or less than what you would use for a bath. And then, you know, for yourself, you know, you don't have to ask an expert. You can actually figure out that question. And for most people, you know, showers use less water, but for some people, I'm sure that take, you know, half hour showers, you know, the tub would run over. You know, for me, that's the whole point, you know, try to learn stuff. You know, I mean, if you look at my stratospheric thing, you know, the cool part, I mean, it was fun seeing the darkness of space and the curvature of the Earth. Don't get me wrong, that was super fun. But I also got to work with super smart people, balloon people and aeromedicine people and, you know, environmental people and all these different things combined in a way that I wouldn't have got to learn it or meet those people, for that matter, without stretching out of my comfort zone a bit. So anyway, it was fun.
Is it okay if some of the students ask you some questions?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
All right. We have Leo in France. Leo, you had a really good question. You should be able to unmute and ask.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Wonderful. I would like to ask you, so from what I know that is mm-hmm. that you went to university in Florida, mm-hmm. correct?
University of Central Florida.
Yes. And I was wondering how you transitioned from going to university and graduating into working with startups in Silicon Valley in California.
Oh, that's a great question. Really, really good question. Yeah, I was in Florida, a university called University of Central Florida. At the time, it was called Florida Technological University. What happened was I wrote a paper. It was part of my master's thesis, and it got accepted to a really, really major conference, probably the largest design automation conference in the world at the time, and it was in Las Vegas. So I don't think I'd been on a plane very many times, and I certainly never been to a Caesar's Palace, which is this giant, beautiful hotel in Las Vegas. And I'm standing in line to get my hotel room, and two people were behind me. I started up a conversation with them, or they started it up with me, I think. They probably saw how nervous I was. And so anyway, it turns out they were from Stanford, and they were doing work in the same area, obviously, that I was, because it was a conference in that area. And I had actually used their software before. And so we struck up a conversation, and we spent a lot of time together at the conference. They came to my talk, and I went to their talks, and it was great. And we really hit it off. We went to Hoover Dam together and took the tour, which was super fun because they're super smart and people. And anyway, I get back to school, and I get an email message from one of them saying, hey, do you want to come out to Stanford and do some research with our research group? And it was like, I talked to my advisor. I said, hey, you know, I just got this invitation. He said, sure, go right ahead. That'll be great for you. It'd be good for us in the program, too, to learn more about what's going on over there. So I flew out there and I got an apartment and actually stayed in somebody's house, in a room in their house and stayed there for almost a year. And I met them, and when I left, they told me they were about to start a company. And when I finished my PhD, you know, if I could come back, they would love to hire me, which is very, very flattering. And so it took me about a year to finish up my PhD, maybe a little more. And by that time they started their company. And so I came and joined their company and was there for 2 years, left and went to a research lab, Digital Equipment Corporation, which got bought by Compaq, which got bought by HP, and then I left to go to Google, and that's the last job other than this, you know, little CEO autonomous, you know, undersea exploration company, But anyway, so it was really, I mean, from being a kid in Florida, hardly ever leaving the state, to, you know, coming out to Silicon Valley and being introduced to all these wonderful people and learning, a lot about, how things get done here. It was super helpful. But anyway, it just goes back to the theme that your paths are not, somebody once told me, about career paths. They said there's this beautiful view. It's a woman, Nora Denzel. She's the one that mentioned to me. She said, a lot of people think about career paths. And she goes, I've never found it to be a path. She goes, paths are these beautiful, paved things that go like this, gardens on each side and stuff like that. She goes, that's not it. She goes, it's not a career path. It's an obstacle course. There's things you have to jump over, climb over, dig under, people knock you off, the weather gets horrible, it's like that's what careers are really like. So don't let people fool you. Because a lot of people, when they think about a path, as soon as they hit an obstacle, they go, oh my gosh, I don't know what I'm doing. If you think about it as an obstacle course, you say, oh yeah, of course this giant pit full of water is in front of me. I gotta figure out how to deal with this pit of water. Should I swim it? Should I jump it? Should I pole vault it? Should I go around it? I mean, that's what life's really like. There's a lot of setbacks along the way.
So we have a couple more questions. Sorry, we don't want to keep you too much, because I know that you probably have some really, really precious time. But we have Maria in Spain, and she had a pretty good question for you. Maria, you had a question about his engineering background.
Who got you, hey sir, who got you into engineering?
So that's a great question. My dad was a mechanical engineer. He worked for Martin Marietta. He actually worked on some parts of the space shuttle and a bunch of other projects. So I learned, from him about, he was always bringing home things and learning about it. We did a lot of experiments at home and stuff like that. So he was the one that got me into engineering and mechanical engineering. But it's funny, because when I went to school, I was on a debate scholarship for a short period of time, and then transferred into mechanical engineering. And I wasn't doing very well in mechanical engineering. It wasn't for me. The courses were really hard. I did okay until I got to thermodynamics, and thermodynamics is super hard. It was a super hard question. But the same time I took thermodynamics, I also took this course in computer programming, a computer language called Fortran. And I loved the computer programming. I could spend all day and all night writing programs for computers. And thermodynamics, I was just barely getting by, studying as hard as I could. And so I switched majors at that time. I went into computers rather than mechanical engineering. And I went to the co-op, because I had a co-op set up this, you can work over the summer and get work experience and come back. And I went to him because he had a mechanical engineering co-op set up for me. And I said, I'm sorry, I'm going to switch majors. Do you have anything in computer science? Do you have any jobs, internships, co-op opportunities in computer science? And he put his arm around me and said, Alan, I'm sorry to tell you, there just aren't any jobs in computer science. And I said, oh, well, I love it so much, I'm going to do it anyway, even if there are no jobs in it. And so I switched over. But here's the strange part. So I spent my whole career in computer science, which I love, and it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. But then all these projects that I'm doing, actually the mechanical engineering has come back to me, all the time. It's like, every project I'm on, on the hardware side, have all this really cool mechanical engineering. So now I'm coming back into mechanical engineering from, the point of view of, I really want to be able to do this, like I want to build something that can go to the bottom of the ocean and deal with 16,000 PSI pressure, for you metric people, 103 megapascals of pressure, enormous amount of pressure down there. And boy, I'd love to go back and understand the mechanical engineering more, because it would really help me right now.
Yeah, I feel like you would be in a special category as someone who has gone so high and now you're going so low. That is a very small club you're probably in.
Well, it's funny. There are people that have gone to the highest and the bottom, but the undersea stuff is all autonomous. I mean, the thing goes there, the vehicle goes down there, not me. My wife would never let me go down the bottom of the ocean, especially in a vehicle that I designed. Maybe if I have done submersibles before. I've been down to 2,000 meters before, which was really fun and things like that. But to efficiently, my view is you really want to efficiently explore the oceans, and to do that, you, a single vehicle with a single person isn't going to be, it's not a way to understand the oceans to the depth that I think. I mean, the joke is we know more about the surface of Mars than we do our own oceans, which is 70% of the landmass of the country, of the planet. And, you know, for me, it's like, boy, that's, it used to just make me laugh about that, you know. But now lately, it's kind of making me angry. It's like, it's not that I don't believe in Mars explorations. I love those guys. JPL is a wonderful thing. I mean, you guys saw the moon landing. I mean, the Mars landing. It was like spectacular. It was beautiful. But I do feel like we've underinvested in understanding our oceans. So, you know, my view is we should be able to build, you know, cheap vehicles, you know, maybe $10,000 each or something like that, and build thousands of them, honestly, to spend a lot of time in the ocean understanding what it is. And so that's kind of what we're working on now.
So I'll read this for, because we've actually got this question from it's pretty unique because it's the same question from students in different parts of the world, both in Las Vegas as well as in Europe. But they want to know, what was it like free falling? How long did you free fall, and did you spin around really fast when you were free falling?
So one of the things people may remember, Felix Baumgartner and Red Bull attempt, and Felix didn't use a drogue chute. He declined the drogue chute because he wanted to make sure he went over Mach 1. He would have gone over Mach 1 anyway, but he declined to use that. And as a result, when he came out, he actually went into an inverted flat spin. He was actually upside down, you know, spinning in a flat spin. And flat spins are super dangerous because if you get into a flat spin, what happens is the faster you spin, the more centrifugal force that you have, and it forces the blood up toward your head and down toward your feet. Now, down toward your feet doesn't really matter so much, but the forcing blood up to your head causes an increase in pressure of that blood inside your blood vessels. And if that pressure gets high enough from that spin, they explode, and you can have strokes and other things. So it's very, very dangerous to spin. And he was in a flat spin. He almost passed out. It came very close to passing out. And then he righted the flat spin, and everything went fine. But when we saw that, we said, you know, we're going to design a system that's spin proof, or at least spin resistant. So I didn't have to worry about spins, you know, and I didn't have to worry about being not face to the earth. We had designed this beautiful, elegant system that would allow me to not have to worry about flat spins. But the jump itself was beautiful. I mean, we went up, we had done two previous jumps, one at 55,000, one at 105,000. We got up to 135,000. The only thing that was really going to be different is the air is super thin. I mean, you're above 99.8%. The views are a lot better. You know, it's 135,000 feet. The darkness of space is everywhere. It's beautiful. Curvature of the earth is beautiful. But the only thing is you're going to go a lot faster. You're going to go to Mach 1.22, whereas the previous test never exceeded Mach 1. And so then what happens is we are set up so that I do a flat release, so that, you know, and the idea is you were going to do a release that didn't have you turning or spinning or anything like that. But because of the strange, I can go into the mechanical engineering, but there's just a slight asymmetry. So when I release, it's zero G. I mean, it literally is zero G because you're falling at exactly the rate of gravity. So the gravity in relation to you is zero. So you're just floating. I mean, in my case, I did this little backflip, and then, which was, you know, you think backflips are, you know, kind of bad, you know, you kind of get scared because you're like, but for me, it was kind of nice because I got to see the balloon. I'd never seen the balloon falling away from a balloon before. And the balloon, I mean, you think these balloons are small, and on the ground, they're kind of small, but when they go up, they expand, and you can put any football stadium, you know, I mean, football meaning soccer, or football meaning football, you know, American football. You put any of those stadiums, 100,000 people, you put it inside that balloon. That balloon is giant, you know. And so when I fell backwards, I could see the thing, this giant balloon, and I could see myself receding away from it, and it getting smaller and smaller. But total quiet, silence, totally silence. The only thing you hear is your own breathing, you know. And then it stays that way for like 50 seconds or something like that, where it's total silence. And you have no feeling of speed at all. You do not feel like you're going fast or slow. There's no noise. You can't calibrate how fast you're going. And then all of a sudden you start to hear sound. And when you hear sound, that means you're slowing down. You're starting to hit the Earth's atmosphere because of your speed and because of how many, what the pressure is against it, it starts to slow you down. And then you just continually slow down the entire way until you get down to, opening altitude, which is 10,000 feet above the ground. So the descent took 4 minutes and 27 seconds, which goes by pretty quickly. Although I must say, it's kind of funny because there's only a few people in the world. I went to a skydiving conference one time they're the only people that has saw the entire 4 minute and 27 seconds of descent. And they loved it, obviously. But 4 minutes and 27 seconds is a long time, you know. If I played that video for you, you guys would be yawning. It's a long time. But it's kind of cool to go faster than the speed of sound. You have no indication that you crossed the speed of sound. There's no difference in hearing or anything. But what's cool is the people on the ground actually heard a sonic boom. So I made a sonic boom, which I don't think there's too many people that have made sonic booms, you know, me and Felix and just using their body, not using a jet. So anyway, that was cool.
I think that's another thing that's absolutely incredible that you can check off that only person to have done that.
I like Felix and I love that program. They did an amazing job, but he actually went faster than me because he didn't have a drug. He went from lower altitude, but he actually went a little faster. So he's like 1.25 Mach. I'm Mach 1.22 and he's Mach 1.27. So I've got the altitude record, but he's got the speed record, which seems totally fair.
Yeah, I think in either case, that's just absolutely incredible. Well, I don't want to take any more of your time, but before we let you go, is there any kind of advice you would give to these kids as they go off into the world and kind of figure out what they want to do in life, whether it's working in STEM, working startups, whatever it may be, what kind of advice would you have for these kids as they figure out what they want to do with their lives?
Yeah, I think, you know, my advice, figure out who you want to work with. Figure out the things that you're interested in and who you want to work with. And I think who you want to work with is more important a lot of times because, you get this grand, idea of, going to do, I don't know, go to Mars or something like that, which is a great idea. In your lifetime, you may actually get that opportunity to buy a ticket to Mars. I don't think my lifetime is going to be long enough for that unless they solve the aging problem, which there are a lot of people working on, honestly. And they're making a lot of progress. But, for me, figure out who you want to work with and figure out what you want to do. Don't define it really narrowly. I think a lot of people, pick one thing, and they say, I want to be a doctor or something. And that's fine for a lot of people. That's fine. But and then they just focus on that. But I think the cool thing in life is that, for me, I wanted to focus on mechanical engineering. And then I realized that wasn't where, that wasn't what I was good at. It's one thing to focus on something that you love. But you also focus on something that you love that you're good at, I might love to be a, concert pianist or something, but I have no musical talent at all. I might want to be an opera singer, but believe me, you do not want to hear me sing. So focus on something that you're good at and then focus on something that other people will appreciate. And if you do that and open yourself up to way wider sets of possibilities, and then explore as you go along. Don't be so rigid. I have a management philosophy after managing at Google. And, I think I had managed 17,000 people or something like that in my organization at Google. And, one of the things that I came away thinking is it's not about planning. Some people think they can plan their way out of things. Like, hey, if I just spend another 3 months planning or another year planning, then I won't get any surprises and things will go faster because I planned more and in the end. My view is that's totally false. You can plan, don't forget planning, do that. But doing is where you learn and planning can't solve all the problems that you're gonna come up with. So in your career, you know, don't spend all your time planning for a single outcome. That's, you know, because there's not going to be one outcome. And there's not going to be one setback that's going to knock you off. You know, plan and say, wow, I'm interested in these 20 things, you know, and I'm going to explore a lot of different options. And even if I start down one path, I want to be flexible enough to be able to take care of whatever opportunity comes with me. I mean, being in line at, you know, the Design Automation Conference, you know, and meeting these two guys, that changed my life. That changed where I went, you know, who I interacted with. It changed where I lived. It changed, you know, who I associated with. It changed what companies I got to work with. I mean, everything was related to that one moment in time. And there's going to be a moment in time like that for you. And you know, open yourself up to these, you know, amazing serendipitous things that are going to happen to you. And by the way, if you ask any adult, you know, say, name one moment in your life where something happened in that moment that actually made a tremendous change in where you were headed and where you were going, every single one of them will have that moment. Maybe it's the moment they met their, you know, wife or husband, or, you know, maybe it's a moment where they learned something new and it saved their life or whatever, but we all have those moments. So open yourself up to them. It's the funnest thing to be surprised about what you like and what you're interested in and what you want to do. So anyway, that's my advice.